Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, there you are. Yes, it's me, Joe Haddo, and welcome to another episode of Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. In this episode, I'm joined by two brilliant authors whose writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The Guardian, The New York Times, and Granta, to name just a few. My first guest published his debut collection of short stories, Mothers, earlier this year, which was longlisted for the Folio Prize and the Edge Hill Prize. His debut novel is due to be published sometime soon. Chris Power, welcome to Book Off.
Hello.
Lovely to see you. And my second guest joins us all the way from America and has just published Furious Hours, which is an incredible story of a serial killer and his murder trial woven with an account of Harper Lee's quest to write another book. Welcome to you, Casey Sepp.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Sorry, I was going to say sorry you had to sort of trudge through the rain and the streets of London, but maybe you're a bit used to that from where you come from.
The rain, yeah. Absolutely. It's familiar weather, and you know, I'm near enough to DC, familiar protesting. It just kind of wafts across the Chesapeake Bay. You can learn about the political climate by stepping outside your door.
So you were battling protest to get to the studio, were you, today?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. Walked up from Westminster and had a look at, you know, what's going on in the world, and you know, these brave people trying to do something about the climate and save the rest of us while we just go about our days. Mm. And fair enough, you know, some EU folks rallying in front of Downing Street. So, yeah, braving the weather, braving the world, persisting.
Good on them, I say.
Yeah.
Good on them. While
we sit in the
warmth of this studio.
Yeah, yeah.
Depleting the world's energy supply.
Exactly, yeah. And Chris, you haven't come quite as far for this recording, being a fellow Hackneyite, as I am.
No, I did come by public transport, though.
Very good.
Yeah, no, it was a short hop from home.
And what we're going to do in this episode is, as we do with every Book Off, talk about your latest books, talk about your writing, and also there will be the Book Off at the end of the episode, where each of you gets 3 minutes on the clock to pitch us and the lovely listeners a book that you love. Not your favourite book, but a book that you love that you think we should all read. And we'll find out what they are a bit later on. Casey, could I come to you first to talk about Furious Hours, which came out in May? This is just quite a remarkable story. So where did it all come from?
Yeah, fair enough. So this book is sort of interesting. The first two-thirds of it really are about this murder trial and the series of murders that took place in the 1970s in a small town in Alabama, one of these deep South states. And it was already a notable case in this part of the world. People had followed it. It was quite sensational. A Baptist minister accused of killing five of his family members for the insurance money, and he was gunned down at the funeral of his last victim by another relative of that person. And the vigilante's trial was just as sensational as all of the murder investigations that had come before. And, you know, the life insurance, which had been the putative motive for those murders, continued to be scrutinized and talked about. And so it was already well known, but then Harper Lee, the woman who'd written To Kill a Mockingbird, found out about the case and moved to this town just the way she had with Capote out in Kansas to work on In Cold Blood, and spent 9 months in town and many years after that trying to write a book. And so for me, you know, the murder trial and the murder stories were interesting enough, but you add Harper Lee to the mix and suddenly it's a deeper, more interesting interesting story about the kinds of stories we tell and who gets to write them and how difficult they are when they come together. And for Harper Lee's concerns, this was the opportunity to sort of remedy some of the ethical objections she'd had to In Cold Blood. So there's this other dimension, which I think is quite topical today, about true crime and how it is we write it, and once again the kinds of stories that get told, and kind of messy ethics of looking at these dark parts of our life as a society, trying to make peace with one another and get along and find justice and find a way to hold people responsible for the things they do and understand why they do them. So there's a lot going on for her, which is then understandably why she doesn't seem to have finished the book.
And what made you, or what was the spark that you thought, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, great question. So I had loved Harper Lee's work when I was a kid, and I feel kind of lucky. We all hope to get to grow up and write about the things we care about as children, and I was able to do it.
Yeah.
So I went to the town where Harper Lee was born and raised, which is another small town in Alabama, and I was working on a story for The New Yorker about her second novel, Ghost at a Watchman, which I think made the splash here that it did in the U.S. Five decades, Harper Lee had said she was never going to publish another book, and then the year before she died, she announced she was publishing another book. And so I went down to write a story about Ghost at a Watchman, and while I was in Alabama, found out about this other book she had tried to write. And what was interesting is, because Harper Lee was going to write about the Reverend Maxwell, the alleged serial killer, it meant no other writers really had bothered to. She was kind of squatting on the story. And, no one wanted to put too much work into this case because you didn't want to be scooped by Harper Lee. And, your book didn't stand a chance if Harper Lee's was going to come out. And I had learned enough about kind of, where she was in her life. And it seemed very unlikely she would, in fact, publish The Reverend if she had, in fact, written it. And, of course, the real difference was I could write a book that included her, which she was such a pathologically private person, she would never have made herself a character in the book. Mm. And so unlike some of the true crime stories we read today, where the journalist is very much a part of the story, and even podcasts, which sort of build in a subjectivity from the person investigating it or trying to make sense of what had happened, Harper Lee was just never going to do that. Mm. So it seemed like there was a book to be written that included her, and that's what I spent a few years working on. And it's been a pleasure to go around talking about it, because it's the chance to talk about her and to talk about true crime and to talk about literary biography, because I think for me it was an exciting way to tell the life story of a writer without telling that exclusively, and a way so often those biographies are about the kind of success of a writer's life, the books we know. And this was the chance, first of all, to just look at this kind of unknown part of her life. No one had really followed this case after, people in the local area had, but the kind of national and international community hadn't. And moreover, it was the chance to just look at failure and unfinishedness and the kind of ambitious project of a writer who's most known for her successful book, and the chance to really look at, well, what happened after that.
Mm. It's a brilliant book, and I want to talk more about that sort of explosion of true crime a bit later on as well. Chris, you've been to that part of the world down in Alabama?
I've been through it on an Amtrak train. I studied in the States for a year. I was in Illinois back in the 90s, and at the end of that year, I got a train from, I think, Chicago down to Washington, and then went through Alabama and down to Louisiana and across the Panhandle and up.
You might well have been on that train with Harper Lee. The thing to tell you is she was terrified of airplanes, she traveled almost exclusively by Amtrak. So you'll have to really search your memory. Was there a little lady?
Okay, next time I tell that story, I'm going to be like, and it was amazing.
Yeah, Harper Lee was on the
observation deck.
I like it.
Hanging out. Yeah. Was she writing it was it going to be a novel, or was it going to be sort of?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, she started out very insistent that it was true crime, and that she went around kind of banging the drum of accurate journalism and nonfiction of the old-fashioned kind. And again, she had made so much about her objections to what Capote had done and the fabrications and the elaborations of In Cold Blood. So she set out to do the opposite and insisted it was just going to be straight nonfiction. But there's a little bit of the book that exists, and that seems to be fictionalized. At least it's changed some character names and added a little bit of a backstory. And so at some point in her frustrations, it seems like she at least entered entertain the possibility of a novel, which makes sense. That's all she had written up to that point. She had helped Capote with In Cold Blood, and you know, she'd worked some as a journalist in college, and her father had owned a newspaper, so she was familiar with the techniques of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. But to that point, the only books she had written were novels. So it seems like at some point, when she couldn't find enough facts and when enough of the original story didn't come together, she seems to have toyed with a novel too.
Mm-hmm. What do we think of In Cold Blood? Are we fans?
I've never read it.
Oh gosh, funny. Just, but was there any pressure to?
No,
you know, like, well, as it come up at
maybe
various points?
Not, maybe it was like reverse pressure, because it was my mum cited it as one of her favourite books. That sounds like my mum's not around. She is around. But I remember her talking to me about it when I was a teenager, I guess. And I don't know, a description of it now would make... I would think that teenage me would have been like all over that, like a rash.
Yeah.
It sounds great. But I don't know, I think sort of the moment passed me by, and then I was off into the beats and I was into, you know.
Do you know Capote's fiction, though? I'm so curious.
Yeah. I've read, I used to have a reader that had a lot of his short stories in it, and sort of some of Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Sure.
It was like... yeah, it was a Penguin edition. We're recording this in Penguin, so it seems appropriate. yeah, so I knew the short stories, but yeah, never read In Cold Blood.
Because I only read it a couple of years ago, but I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I wasn't quite ready for it. I didn't really know what to expect. I just knew that it was one of those texts that everyone says, you know, In Cold Blood. And I just thought, right, got to get around to it. And I really did lap it up, actually, I have to say.
Yeah, it's quite seductive. I mean, it's a beautifully written book, and you know, it provides satisfactions that a lot of true crime nonfiction doesn't, because it offers all the answers, and it really does sort of give you everything you would want to know about what happened. You know, he gets into the mind of the murder victims, and he gets into the minds of the killers. And, you know, it's kind of obvious once you learn about the publication history that some of that is necessarily fabricated and exaggerated and liberties were taken, as we say. And also that, you know, he was this tremendous fiction stylist. And so in some ways just couldn't resist doing what he did so well elsewhere in Cold Blood. So yeah, I'd say how about tortured fan? That's what I'll say. I really like it. I had this kind of disastrous experience. I don't know how much you read short stories when you're working on yours, or novels when you're working on your longer fiction works, but at some point I reread In Cold Blood thinking, okay, I'm at the writing stage, I want to just look at it again, and just thought, oh gosh, I have to stop, it's too really? Good. I'll never be able to provide this much information about my case, and you know, I'll never be able to offer these kinds of resolutions. So I put it down, and then, you know, went back to reading like 19th century labor histories of Alabama, and that felt easier to top. But do you read much when you're working?
Yeah, I do. I imagined Mothers is my first book, and I imagined when I was sort of in the latter stages of editing it that I would not read anything, because I'd often heard writers say, well, I don't read any fiction when I'm writing fiction or whatever. But I think during one edit, I didn't read any fiction for like 3 months, and that must be the longest I've never read fiction since I started reading. And I just couldn't hack it after that. I kind of had to go back to it. I've been writing a novel for the last year, and I haven't stopped doing anything. I plan to be very ascetic and just me and the novel, possibly in a bare white space. Read one tweet a day or something. But I've just been reading everything, saying yes to reviews, doing sort of, you know, mixing everything into the pot with the sort of either, you know, foolish overconfidence perhaps that my, you know, my voice, whatever it is, will kind of be able to resist, you know, influence. So I think for many years when I was younger, I was writing very fitfully, and I was writing very kind of, plagiaristically, maybe. I think I was very much, I was taking on the style of whatever really good book I'd just read recently, which now I think was sort of valuable. I think I was working a lot of stuff out.
I think it's what everyone does. Yeah, exactly. Right.
I think maybe I've been through that and I can kind of resist it. I haven't noticed in the last few years anything so seductive that it's kind of really got its claws into me. I've suddenly caught myself like writing in that style. I can totally believe it happens though. I can totally believe I'm as open to it happening as anyone else. And I think it would be quite scary. You'd have to bring the shutters down on that. So I can appreciate you closing the covers pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Mothers, Chris, because as I said, it was published in to great acclaim, longlisted for those prizes, and it is your first short story collection. And Mothers is perhaps a slightly not misleading title. That makes it sound wrong, but you know,
I hope not.
It's not necessarily what you'd think it's going to be about.
No, I have had conversations with a couple of people who are like, why do you call this Mothers? Expecting to be very, I don't know, overdetermined, or I'm not sure. I didn't write to any theme. I mean, I wrote the stories over quite a long period of time, several years, just sort of going story by story without any other thoughts in mind. But when I did start reading them together as a body of work and as a collection, it became apparent that I think sort of 7 out of 10 stories, mothers are very present in the text, very present to me. I think in a couple of those cases, it's very kind of subtle, perhaps, but they are present there. And not just mothers as characters, but also having a mother as well. You know, that's quite a relevant theme in the book, or something that recurs with. And obviously, everyone does have a mother, and even if it's an absent mother, that's still a large presence in someone's mind. But I think what I got most interested in that aspect was the kind of idea. There's a recurring character in the book, a woman called Ava, and the first story in the book is about her childhood in Sweden, and then we in the middle story of the book, it's her as a young woman, and in the final story, her later in her life. And she loses her mother quite young, just on the cusp of sort of when you get to know that your mum's like a real person, you know, like your mum's sort of this a mother is a shape, and it's a thing. And if you're lucky enough to have sort of, you know, a present mother, it's a hugely important presence. But you kind of, as you get a bit older, you suddenly realize there's this whole hinterland to this person. They are a person. You know? They're not just
serving you,
your mother. They're serving you or berating you or whatever it is. But they sort of conform to this, in your mind, this rigid thing. And that's always quite a resonant part of like growing up, when you kind of realize that these people have three dimensions. And in my mum's case, her dad died when she was six. And it's been interesting as she's got older. She's 80 now, and she sort of talks more and more in the last few years about her dad. And you can see how important he's always like been to her, even though they were sort of together for such a tiny fragment of her life. And in terms of sort of active memories, a real sliver of time, but a huge presence. And my wife's dad died when she was young. These were both sudden deaths. When I was writing particularly about that character Ava, this became a sort of active theme as I was telling her story. That idea that someone's sort of had their relationship with someone truncated, and then when they in turn become a mother or become a parent, that's bound to sort of churn up some sort of fundamental emotions.
Do you know this poet, Kevin Young?
No.
He's a nonfiction writer too. His last book, I think, was called Bunk, and it was about a kind of history of these hoaxes and frauds and things. But Kevin lost his father, and he wrote a book of poems, but he also put together an anthology of kind of grief and loss and mourning. And I heard him interviewed about that anthology, and he said this striking thing about how we have this notion of motherhood and fatherhood, but he'd been so taken by the idea of sonhood that so much of his identity was defined as being his father's son.
Right.
And that a lot of what was lost was that relationship, not just to each other, but to the world, as being defined as his father's son. And it was so striking, because I think very much the way the culture does. I think of my parents as parents and don't often think of myself as the daughter in relationship mm-hmm. to them. So it's always a kind of two-way relationship. It's quite striking to think about someone contemplating that, both in loss and presence and in capitulation and, you know, recurrence in that way. So it's quite beautiful to think about.
Mm. And it is quite amazing to think about the sort of full circle of that parenting and being a being a son or daughter. You know, it's the looking up while they're looking down, and then that shift, and then the way that you sort of you end up looking after your parents essentially at the end. You know, that whole full circle thing is it recurs quite a lot in fiction, I would say, actually. It's quite a powerful thing to write about, I imagine.
Well, yeah, and turning into your parents as well, which yes. I definitely noticed since I had kids, and I'm I catch myself and I'm like, what did I just say? This is crazy. I mean, if you want any arguments for kind of you know, inherited behaviours or DNA or whatever, it's right there. It's quite uncanny.
No test needed. Just look at this.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
How have you found? I know you said you're working on your first novel, which is really exciting. How have you found changing your writing style from short stories into prose, or has it not really affected you?
It's definitely affected me. I think. I find all writing difficult, so I don't really hold to the kind of thing you hear about, you know, short stories being the hardest form because every word has to count or whatever. I think it's all pretty tough, whatever you're writing. But I think I guess the biggest difference is the sort of is the endurance and the marathon aspect of it, because you know, with a short story you can probably tell within a few weeks if it's going somewhere.
Right.
It might take you years to complete it, and it might be a success or a failure, but you can kind of see if there's something basically workable in there. With a novel, I've found there was a much longer period of kind of really not being uncertain whether the whole thing was just gonna fall apart or not. And you just kind of have to tell yourself to get through it and get the first draft done and then see where you're at, you know. So there was a greater period of uncertainty, I'd say. But otherwise, putting the marks on the page is pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm. And Casey, how long a journey was this book for you?
So I started the book in 2015. I wrote a short article for The New Yorker about the Maxwell case, which is the kind of serial killer story at the beginning, and then just realized how much more there was to say about that and about Harper Lee's work on it. And it's so funny, you know, the poor fiction writers are interrogated all the time, but no one goes around, you know, pressing journalists on, is there a difference between an article and a book? How do you know which is which? And, you know, it's just sort of, it's more permissive to move between the two. Like, you know, I say, oh, it started as an article and I expanded into a book, and people kind of nod along like, yeah, that's fine. But if you were to say, you know, it was a short story and then I moved, they say, how did you know and at what moment?
Sure.
And, you know,
hey,
some
Casey,
of that.
Was it hard to go from an article to writing a whole book?
But, you know, it's just path dependent with nonfiction. It depends on how much sourcing comes together, you know, who'll talk to you, what documents turn up, who's alive and who's not. And so I was really lucky. It turned into a book when I just realized there were so many more people to talk to, and friends and family of Harper Lee's who had never talked about her before were suddenly willing to, and more of her letters turned up. And for me, those are the things that made it worthwhile. And, you know, it seemed very early on there was going to be a lot more to say about her and that the book would kind of work as a whole. And then, I mean, I certainly agree. You just have to put one word at a time on the page, no matter what you're writing. I don't think I experienced it quite as hard, but it is, of course, the endurance of a book. You know, you have to put more of them down at some point. And it was quite interesting for me because the last third of the book is about Harper Lee, and she is someone who was a very tortured writer and suffered from writer's block and suffered from depression and had a drinking problem. And, you know, all of these things just went round and round and contributed to one another and ultimately just really thwarted her productivity. And at some point I realized that was going to be kind of the trickiest thing for me to write. I thought we had so much in common. Yeah. I thought it would be easy. I'm a writer. She's a writer. I would just write about writing. And she just had a very different experience of it. And I think that even more than some of the true crime stuff, you know, writing sensitively about someone's death or accurately about murder accusations or a trial. The actual kind of hard writing was about her and making it emotionally interesting. Because again, this book in some ways is very much about failure. And for me, writer's block feels like paint drying. So it was sort of like, well, how do you make this interesting? And how do you get people emotionally involved in her work and in the kind of less successful period of her life? But at the end of the day, I was just glad that that's the kind of story of her, not me. It wasn't contagious. I didn't feel any differently about my work after having written about hers.
She's quite amazing, really, in the sense of her fame and that one book. And yet, you know, that is, Bargo said, a Watchman, what she wrote. That's what she wrote up right up until, as you mentioned, her death.
Yeah, it's really nutty. These people who knew her. So Harper Lee lived most of her adult life in New York City. You know, she went back and forth to Alabama, but she had an apartment on the Upper East Side. She actually lived for a little while with Hall and Oates, the musicians. not in the same apartment, but in the same building. And you know, her fame is interesting.
Manning, I bring or Harper.
I wish that had been the outcome of my research. No, in fact, what I was about to say in terms of her fame is, in fact, they had no idea who she was. They lived on the same floor of this building in New York and long after Mockingbird, and they had no idea because she was this inconspicuous middle-aged and then elderly woman. And she was famous in the sense that anyone could have told you her name, the name of her novel, and probably have recapitulated most of the plot for you, if not from the novel, then from the film adaptation. And yet she was mostly anonymous in New York. She's better known in Alabama. You know, people recognized her. People in that town, it was so small, they knew what she looked like and watched her age. But in New York, at least, you know, she could go drinking in bars and make a scene, and no one knew it was the author of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Which is what she liked.
Which is what she liked about it, exactly. But it is just extraordinary to think about, you know, and since my book has come out, I thought I had thought every possible thought about Harper Lee. But now that the book is out, I just think so much about, she was 34 years old. She had never published anything, you know, truly not even a short story. She had some things in the college literary magazine, but that book came out and it was instantly successful.
It's mad,
and then
it
was relentlessly successful, and it sat on the bestseller list. And then right when it should have dropped off, the film came out and it went right back on. And then the international edition started. And by that point, it was on school syllabi, so everyone continued to read it. And just relentless. It is truly, you know, she's an example of getting everything you might have ever wanted and then not knowing what to do about it.
Yeah. And getting it all in just one fell swoop as well, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
First novel, all in a concentrated amount of time, you know.
Right. You can see why it was hard to try again.
I bloody love The New Yorker. And I read it every week. And I tell you one thing, Casey, I cannot, for the life of me, I try every week to get on that caption competition at the back.
I wish I could give you advice or an insider's track to,
I thought you'd
the
have
truth
some
is I
sort
don't
of...
even get the captions. Like half the time I could never submit one because I find them to be the most inscrutable part of the magazine that, you know, I sort of think I look at one and find it funny and then read the caption and realize I have no idea what it's about.
It's gone
find
beyond.
Find another writer to talk to,
But you do, you contribute relatively regularly to The New Yorker?
Yeah, and mostly book reviews and arts coverage like that. Occasionally, a reported piece. And actually, I think when we get to Book Off, I'm gonna try and get my homework to count double, get double credit. I'm working on a profile of a writer, and I'm gonna talk about one of my favorite books of hers. Because I've been rereading a lot of her work, and it's just a tremendous pleasure. It's a place where, you know, you're. It's not what Orwell said about book reviewing. You really just have weeks to dig into someone's, all of their work and learn about their life and think about what they're doing. And, you know, I feel like it's what I wished for and got with a couple of reviews of my book, just someone who spent time thinking and delighting in it and kind of figuring out how it works. And I like to be able to do that for other writers. And it's nice sometimes with nonfiction, you feel like you're doing it mostly for readers of The New Yorker. You know, you're doing the hard work of, I just finished a piece on Thomas Edison, which required reading three biographies of Thomas Edison. And you think no one in their right mind is going to go read three, you know, reading two others in order to review the one 800-page biography. And then reading, you know, actually Thomas Edison just produced millions of pages of diaries and patent notes and things. And so I looked at some of those and, you know, it's just like a mini seminar on Edison. And,
but we really appreciate
it. I hope so. Yeah, exactly. It's hard won facts in that piece. But no, it's a pleasure. I feel like, you know, I loved school and writing for The New Yorker is like you never left school. You just keep taking these courses on different things. And, you know, you write your paper at the end and, you know. It's better than school. You get paid for it. You don't have to pay for it.
Exactly. And very grateful to you as well, Chris, for your column, the Guardian column, because many discoveries have been made from your short story column.
Nice of you to say so. It's taught me a lot as well. I've written this column on a short story for like 10 years for the Guardian about misguidedly called A Brief Survey of the Short Story, which it was going to be
10 years ago. Seemed like a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I'll do this till Christmas. It'll be fun. Where each one like looks at a different short story writer and just so I kind of deep dive into their work and discuss them and the life if it's relevant, but mainly the work. And yeah, it taught me a huge amount because when I started it, I was like, well, I know about 12 writers I could probably write, you know, an essay on. But I quickly ran up against the limits of my knowledge or ignorance. I'm not sure which way to put it around. But and then I started sort of, it was a great excuse to get round to writers that I'd always meant to read sort of in depth but never had, you know, writers who I'd read a story or two but never really dug down. It was just wonderful because I think any writer kind of does learn a huge amount from reading. You know, it's that combination of what you read and your life experience that kind of forges the work, I think. So
are they always loving? Is it always things you like, or do you sometimes get into?
Yeah, no, it's been interesting because in some occasions you're kind of going in blind and going, well, this person's got an incredible reputation, so I assume I'll like them, you know. And I guess when you're looking at someone's, like the most recent one I did was Nadine Gordimer, and she wrote over 200 short stories. I mean, she sort of thought in short stories at various points in her career through the sort of late 70s, 80s, the novel sort of took over more. But her quality control was kind of all over the place because she was just interested in sort of transforming things into stories, and some of them really hit home and some of them last and some of them are just quite ephemeral. And that's a kind of slog when you're maybe reading, you know, 12 collections together that weren't designed to be read together. Maybe even the stories within a single collection weren't designed to be read together. You kind of bear that in mind, and then where relevant, you can discuss the bad work, but more often focus on the stuff that's potentially going to last. The weird thing with her is that the one extant sort of collected just seems like a bizarrely bad collection of stories.
Oh, gosh.
It's like if this is what we're left with in Nadine Gordon's book, there's a way better one out there that's not collected. Yeah. So that's interesting too, because a lot of stuff is sort of out of print. You know, I'm often, you know, borrowing in libraries or buying old secondhand editions where the glue kind of stinks, and the acid. Americans have acid-free paper. We don't in this country. No. So you buy an English secondhand book, and it really smells like a secondhand book.
You can
turn up some real stuff, and it shows you that it's not always the sort of, you know, the quality work tends to rise, but it's not always the case. Stuff can get lost through the cracks. Or you look at someone like Lucia Berlin, a whole body of work can get lost in the cracks. And thankfully,
I'm so curious. I'm always such a slave to chronology. So much of what I write just has to go from, you know, the year it started to the year it ended. And it's such a wonderful thing to think about if you're a short story writer and you get to put together a collection, or midway through your career, you're assembling, you know, some kind of selection. Do you think short story writers have much self-knowledge about that? Like, do you think if you were talking to Nadine about her work, she would say, oh, right, I knew at the time that was rubbish and I can't believe they put it in? Or do you think there are things that just sort of
that's a good
sense
point.
Of them changes?
I don't know. I know some of them, like Frank O'Connor, for example, a great, you know, New Yorker, many times published in The New Yorker, sort of almost completely rewrote some stories when he was assembling a collected. Mm-hmm. Whereas others were kind of like, that work, and they'd focused on what they're doing
now. What new
now.
Things, yeah.
But for some, it was still very much alive, and they wanted to present it, and obviously present it in the best possible light, and were still self-critical and still self, you know, sort of putting themselves through the motions. The interesting thing with that is that you're not necessarily a better judge at a later date.
Sure,
than
you
were.
So
it's
yeah,
tricky.
I don't know it. I mean, I ask that out of genuine curiosity. I know, you know, obviously a lot of poets do that, and I'm thinking of Yeats, who just tinkered endlessly and you know, changed the order, changed the content, and so I know it from that realm of things that there's a lot of fussiness and discontent that's not settled by publication. So I wondered if for short story writers
the temptation
was to tinker too.
I think there's quite a wide array also. There are some writers who kind of think of short stories as, you know, pieces for the left hand, and their novel is where their novels are where their main focus is.
Mm-hmm.
But then those ones tend not to have huge sort of bodies of work that you want to return to necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some out there who I think wrote some very fine short stories but aren't best known for them, like Samuel Beckett even. Incredible short stories, but he's sort of much more famous for his plays, probably because in that regard he felt compelled to kind of go everywhere where they were doing productions and kind of make sure they got them right, so he devoted much more of his life to that, even though he considered himself a prose writer first and foremost. But it's definitely a mixed bag. Each writer has their foibles.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, it's time for the book off now then, where each of you is going to get 3 minutes, if you need all three, to tell us about a book that you absolutely love. So before we get into it, Casey, can I ask what book you're putting forward for the book off?
Yeah, so this is Marilyn Robinson's first novel. It's called Housekeeping.
Okay. Yeah. And Chris, what about you?
A novel called Sudden Death by Alvaro Enrique.
I feel like you've chosen this intimidating title. You've already won. Oh, jeez.
Hey,
I went with, you know, loving and domestic and tender.
Case.
Yeah, right. Sudden death.
The gloves are off now at this part. So, Casey, would you like to go first or second?
I'll go second with sudden death on the table. Give myself all the time to.
In which case, Chris, would you like to be honked out or rung out at the time?
I think I will have to be honked.
You can be honked.
Can I be honked?
You can be honked as well if you want, yeah. I am going to put 3 minutes on the clock. As I said, you don't have to use them all, but when you get to that 3 minutes, I'm going to be honking you out, all right? So it's over to you, Chris Power, to tell us about Sudden Death by Alvaro Enrique.
Okay, thanks. So Alvaro Enrique is a Mexican writer. I think he's based in New York. I read this book in English, because I am a monoglot, and it's beautifully translated by Natasha Wimmer, who's translated Roberto Bolaño, amongst others. So this book takes as its sort of central event a tennis match played on the streets of Rome in 1599 between Caravaggio, the Italian painter, and Francisco Quevedo, the Spanish poet. This match has actually been played as a duel, as a point of honour at stake. What that isn't revealed until deeper in the book, so I won't reveal it. But The important thing is they're playing with a tennis ball that's stuffed with the hair of Anne Boleyn, hair that was shorn from her head on the morning of her execution, 60 years earlier. And what Enrique does is he uses this object, or actually the set of tennis balls, and their journey across Europe and actually across the globe during that 60-year period to dive into all sorts of subjects like the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, the history of art, the history of music, and most importantly of all, the conquest of New Spain by Cortes and the conquistadors, and this flow of wealth, of material and mineral wealth into Europe that kind of shaped the modern world for centuries to come. So it's kind of a chamber piece, you know. It's very unambitious. What's really amazing is the way he's a really fleet writer. Like parts of this are kind of about him in the New York Public Library researching. So it's got this sort of auto-fictional element. Some of it reads like essays. Some of it's very journalistic. Some of it's like a realist novel. You're kind of with Caravaggio, you know, in his studio. You can smell the tempera on the canvas and the sweat on his robes and the semen on his robe. There is quite a lot of semen in this book. It's pretty bawdy. But the really interesting thing is also it was written in 2013. I think I read it first in 2016 or 17. I read it again earlier this year. And it does seem like one of those sort of regenerating books. It's really about, you know, fundamental themes like power and politics. And there's a great line in it about the pool of blood and shit that history leaves when it goes mad, which doesn't seem inappropriate for the times we're living in. So I think it's one of those books that will continue to give more and more as time passes.
Very good. Woo! Just sort of looked at me as I grabbed for the horn, as it were, and thought, and you were like, I'm just going to bring this home. Fantastic pitch, and love the sound of that. We'll talk about it in a moment. But now you can have a breather, have a sip of that coffee. Casey, it's over to you. I'll put 3 minutes back on the clock, and you're going to tell us about Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson.
Yeah, the truth is I wanted to talk about Housekeeping because I think that Marilyn Robinson is probably best known in the UK for her least known book. She wrote this strange nonfiction book, Mother Country, about a nuclear power plant in the Lake District, and it was quite controversial, and she was sued by Greenpeace, and I'm not even sure it's much read here anymore, but it made her name in a strange way because for most Americans, she was known for this perfect novel she published in 1981 called Housekeeping, and she's truly a writer who came out of nowhere and arrived in the middle of her life with this just extraordinarily beautiful book. And I knew that I loved it. I loved it when I first read it. But she went on to write a trilogy of novels about the first was called Gilead. And then she wrote two others, Lila and Home, about a town in Iowa and some interesting religious characters, some of whom were born religious, some of whom converted, one of whom's a pastor. And the first of those novels, Gilead, is an epistolary book that's quite beautiful, a sort of end-of-life letter by a pastor to his son. And so I fell in love with those because I'm interested in theology, and they're very sophisticated and philosophical. And I had forgotten how much I liked Housekeeping, but because I'm rereading all of her work, I sat with Housekeeping recently and realized it is exactly the same as those later novels, but just quietly and even more deliberately so. And, you know, it's if you like American literature and you know the transcendentalists, what she went and did was transplant transcendentalism west of the Mississippi. And it's a book mostly about three women. So she looked at that New England tradition and says, you know, OK, I'll take Emerson and I'll take Melville, but I will take their style of writing and their philosophy and their kind of threadbare Americanism and just transplant them to a small town in Idaho and make them all women. So it's two sisters and it's kind of a matrilineal story, and they're being raised at this particular moment when we meet them by a kind of nutty aunt of theirs. And so the housekeeping of the title is true. There's a lot about making a home and figuring out who your family is and how to relate to them, but there's this deeper sense of, you know, tending the hearth and figuring out who you are in the world. And it's just extraordinary. And I can't think of another book that does it so well without having to resort to kind of characters who are philosophers or clergy, which she does in these other books. But, you know, these three plain women just wrestling with loneliness and identity and self-reliance, and it is just so beautifully done. And it takes the natural world of the West, which I think is, you know, used often in ways that are violent and masculine and assertive, and just looks at the home in places like that and how we can exist and how we can flourish as intellects in places that seem spare. So I would say if you haven't read it, just go and pick it up immediately. It's truly a perfect book.
Wow, fantastic. Another brilliant pitch. There you go. Have some water, Casey. You're like,
oh, it's true, yeah. The mat okay, for Marilyn breathe. Robinson. We can all I like breathe. It. As if she, you know, needed me to go around evangelizing for her.
No, everyone needs a champion.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, let's talk about both of those, because I absolutely love, Chris, the whole premise of this book that you've said, the tennis match, the characters in it, the power and the politics. And I've written in quite big letters, bawdy.
Whereas I would have written down Caravaggio. Yeah. There you go. Well, me at Caravaggio.
He was pretty bawdy. So
we meet in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've also written Caravaggio in slightly smaller letters. but was this a book that you just discovered by accident, or just one that you'd heard about? How did you come to this book?
Yeah, I think I just read... I don't think I even read... I think I started reading a review of it, and then I was like, actually, I'm not going to... I really want to read this book just from the opening paragraph of this review, so I'm not going to read anything about it. Because, you know, normally the books that come to you kind of know a reasonable amount about before.
Sometimes
it's actually one of the things I like about short story collections is some of the... Because even if you've read a review of a short story collection, you're probably going to encounter a story within there that you have no preconceptions about, which is so rare when you come to read anything. So it's kind of very pure state of reading. And this was the case of this. I just loved the sound of it. I really like that kind of... it's one of those books that when you for the time you're reading it, you almost turn into like a conspiracy nut. You kind of see everything through the filter of this book. And you're like, fuck, that's it. That's like, this explains everything. Which he kind of plays it. I think he calls it a machine for describing the world or something. Yeah. He's talking about novels as machines for describing the world. And because of all its sort of resonances, the way you start thinking like a crazy person, I think, because he talks about this Aztec art, this sort of feather work that these Aztecs made for Catholic clergy, and they sent like mitres back to Europe that on receipt like looked sort of these dull things, and Catholics were used to like, I mean, I was raised Catholic, it's all like bling, you know, it's all like wax and gold on that.
Liturgical camp.
Camp. So they were looking at it like, what's this? But it was this feather work that when it's in a certain light, when it's in sunlight, it becomes kind of iridescent, and it's these incredible emblazoned kind of works that sort of, you know, wowed people. And he talks a lot about the sort of, you know, the imposition of, you know, Catholicism on the Aztecs. There's a great story in there about how a Catholic priest kind of, almost as sort of a model village, he got these Aztecs to create a version of Thomas More's Utopia. The ironic thing being that this sort of, you know, this text that's predicated on its kind of impossibility actually mirrored a lot of the ways of the, you know, pre-conquistador ways of life in the Aztec time before the conquistadors kind of, you know, screwed it up. He's a Mexican writer, so he's writing from that. It's a very political book, as well as a very bawdy one.
As well as bawdy. Political and bawdy. And then over the other side, housekeeping. I just loved how much you obviously love this book and the rereading factor is sort of bringing it, you know, reminding you of it.
Yeah, although it's a corrective for me. I'm a real creature of place, and I actually moved back to where I grew up, and it's one of the things that drew me to Harper Lee. I love Southern literature because it's so distinctive, and I think what must have been happening the first time I read Housekeeping, as much as I liked it, is it's a different region. It's Western. It's Idaho. It's this place I don't even think I'd ever been to when I first read it, but on returning to it, it's just... It does for that place what I hope to do for the places I love. You know, it just saturates you with, you know, you're talking about Caravaggio and the smell of the canvas. Mm. Suddenly you know what life is like in Idaho and what it would be like to sit in a house that's empty all day and covered in dust, or to walk into an orchard in, you know, the twilight and actually experience it. So it, it has the kind of, you know, conjuring feeling that great fiction does. Mm. So I think that's the thing I most liked about it when I returned to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was more charming than the first time even.
You mentioned, you know, how it's an extraordinarily beautiful book. And also I did love that idea that it's about the West, but instead of what we're used to reading about that part of the country, it's actually a bit softer and it's looking at a different
yeah,
side of
absolutely.
That life.
I mean, right, Cormac McCarthy, it's like, are there any women to be found
yeah,
in those
exactly,
pages? And
yeah.
Marilyn Robinson says, like, well, look, I'm gonna give you a matriarchy and show you. I mean, it's not actually that. You know, it's actually women who, for very tragic reasons, have not been partnered, or who lost their spouses, or, you know, to go back to where we started with mothers, it's about yearning to have maternal figures even when there are only women in your life, or to understand your sibling in some way you're supposed to, or yourself in a way that it's assumed you will. So yeah, I like that about it. It feels, it's not as overtly political, you know, it's not consumed with what we typically talk about as politics, but, you know, it's habitually political in that it tries to think about the self in the world and how the self should relate to other people. So yeah, and on top of that, just exquisitely written. You know, I think we live in an age where you're supposed to say that about any novel you read, but it is actually deserved and true of hers that they're just exquisitely written. Mm.
Well, I don't know either of these books. I haven't read them, and you know, it's great to hear two very different books and with the passion behind them. So I got to choose one because, you know, that's the game. And I want to read both of them, but I think on the pitch alone, I'm going to take home Sudden Death for the bawdiness, politics, and Caravaggio.
I like it.
But I'm also just extremely intrigued to read Housekeeping now, because I think you've put Marilyn Robertson on the map.
You can sober up after you read Sudden Death with Housekeeping.
Exactly.
Really. Yeah.
And I'm going to read it. So everyone I know who's read Housekeeping, Gilead, they're the ones I've heard people talk about most. And they've just, everyone I know who's read them has just completely loved it. No one's gone like, oh, that was quite good. It's been like
yeah,
a sort
it's
of
really, it's either rapturous or they never
experience.
Mention
but
it
But you haven't read Marilyn Robertson before?
No.
Okay. Right. Well, let's get one each. Yeah, okay. Then we can swap afterwards.
let's buy both. Give her the royalty.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
She needs it from that Greenpeace lawsuit.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you both so much for joining us and for talking about your books and bringing your some of your favourite books to Book Off. What is next for you both, Chris? I know you've been working on the novel, so that's sort of way in the future, I imagine. Still, is it?
Yeah, it's coming out in March 2021. So
wow.
I'm
okay.
Working to deliver that by the coming March, and then there'll be a year of, you know, associated gubbins.
as there is. And Casey, you've been over for about a week or so, and you're headed back to the States. More projects for books, or are you sort of working on more articles when you get
yeah
there?
I mean I wish that I had a timetable with such certainty. No, I would love to write another book, and I have an idea for one, but it's a lot of journalism in the meantime.
And Furious Hours is out now by Casey Sepp, and Mothers by Chris Power is also out, and they are both brilliant, very different, but both fabulous reads, which we can highly recommend. Casey, Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah.